Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Monday. It's the 12th of July, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. I believe we have a really fascinating broadcast for you today. We're going to be speaking with John Bailey. He's the publisher and editor of the White Plains Citizenet Reporter. So we're going to talk to him about stuff that's going on in White Plains, naturally. And then at 10:30, we'll be speaking to Michael Edelman, Esquire. He's a political analyst and a pundit. He'll be on from 10:30 to 11. And then I'll be with you from 11 to 11:30. But more importantly, Ron Matten, the Republican City Council president candidate, he'll be on with us from 11:30 to 12. I know that he's going to be at a meeting probably till about 11:30, so he may be slightly delayed. Well, let's hope not, but whatever the case is, I'm just aware that that's what's going to be happening. So over here, Mr. Bailey's on the line, which is great. Good morning, Mr. Bailey. How are you, sir?
Good morning from White Plains in New York, USA, where it's 78, miserable, humid, cloudy, just an athletic sock kind of day.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I agree with you.
Really.
So, you know, we got some very interesting stuff that's going on in White Plains, which I read on the White Plains CNR or White Plains Citizenet Reporter.com website. And what was fascinating is the Willow Ridge Country Club, which was sold. And how did that occur? And how did this all come about? Why were they wanting to sell it?
Well, according to the Westchester Business Journal report back in March, okay, they interviewed the mayor of Forest Town, Supervisor Harrison, Ron Belmont.
Yeah,
and Mr. Belmont, in that article, said that the Willow Ridge had been offering their property out to developers, and they were concerned about that, and so they started an eminent domain proceeding to take the land, and that's how it happened. And what happened eventually was that, as it was announced July 6th, I think? July 6th it was announced, that's when they completed the sale. Big, big surprise to everybody.
And what was the big deal for Ron Belmont and Harrison to buy it? Why were they interested in it? Did they make money on this deal?
Well, they don't. What they did was they're paying the Willow Ridge Country Club and its members $13.5 million for the property. And then they are going to run it and pay a developer, a golf course operator, Troon Management, mm-hmm. to run it for them. However, the property has a great deal of property taxes that the property used to pay the town of Harrison, and they lose that.
Mm-hmm.
Belmont said in that article in the Westchester Business Journal, he is quoted as saying that they were concerned about it being developed for homes.
Oh, I see. They were concerned about homes.
Taking the golf course.
Uh-huh.
Well, just in scenarioizing, this was never published, but developers can take a golf course, put condos on it, and really make it very attractive. That used to be a very attractive type of development people would go to,
mm-hmm.
primarily in the South. But I don't see if that
yeah.
would work And this was, and they were, and Willow Ridge was having some problems keeping up the course, and it was losing money. So the club members come out smelling like a rose. They split $13.5 million
mm-hmm.
of taxpayer money, that, I would like to point out.
Yeah. So the benefit, so, the benefit, in order to maintain the sensibilities of the community, this made a lot of sense for it to be purchased, and to,
yes,
and that's to keep development from encroaching.
Yes.
And then what does the community do? Will they be able to financially see the day through, because they were paying taxes even though they were losing money? I think
Harrison
was losing over $10 million.
Yeah, well, Harrison is going to make this a private semi-public course, which
mm-hmm.
means apparently club members who have already been paid for the property will still get to play there.
I
That's
see.
What I interpret that to mean. And uh-huh. so essentially this is the town of Harrison taking the country club off the hook, making it more public, and preserving the entire area. But now the irony of this is what the city of White Plains attempted to do with the Ridgeway Country Club, i.e. the Fasney property that was Fasney,
mm-hmm.
French American School in New York, had acquired. And Adam Bradley, the former mayor, back in 2010, I believe that's the year, offered them $9 million for it, a below market price, but the Common Council
mm-hmm.
didn't want to do that deal because Adam Bradley thought of it, and they were trying to get him out of the mayoralship because of his problems at the time with his wife, which essentially were in a second trial ordered by the appellate
mm-hmm.
court, found him completely innocent of all charges. So they when the Common Council in White Plains rejected that golf club idea, that was also something that the neighborhood didn't want, because they were going to put a swimming facility there and make it really public, and the neighbors were concerned that the ambiance of the area would be disturbed.
Mm. You know, it does. You know,
very similar
hearing
case.
Hearing you talking about the former mayor Bradley in White Plains, I realize mm-hmm. that in politics and everything that one does in the political world, either they like you or they can't stand you. And if they don't like you for whatever reasons, then they become so adversarial, it's almost impossible. It becomes toxic to be able to govern. And we've seen that whether we agree with the principles at the top of the food chain, wherever that may be, whether it be the president, whether it be a senator, whether it be an assemblyman, whether it be mayors, and so on and so forth. Are we ever going to get beyond that? And look for the
I don't
look
think
for the
that's going to happen anytime soon. I mean, you just look at the paper every day. And, I mean,
yeah.
people are going crazy in this country. Absolutely crazy. And particularly down in Texas, you know, I mean, that is just
a hotbed
of blatant anti-people of color prejudice. I mean, that's the only way you can describe it.
Mm.
You would,
well, you know,
you ask white people to wait hours to vote, to carry IDs. Everybody has IDs. They have driver's licenses, and they have all sorts of stuff. What kind of ID do they want for special minorities? They never spell that out. The legislation.
Well, I never understood.
It's unbelievable.
I never understood that, because if you have a driver's license, there's nothing on a driver's license that says you have a right to vote, does it? It doesn't tell you if you're a citizen
or not. No, but it proves your residence. It proves your residence.
Oh, uh-huh.
You cannot, at least in New York, you cannot get a driver's license if you're not a resident and a of the state. And but at least that's the way, you know, when Spitzer tried to change that, the another governor who ran afoul of his libido and got dumped, I mean, unceremoniously.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that was one thing. That was one of the most unbelievable things ever to happen. And it used to happen in the 19th century, but gee whiz. But
absolutely.
21st century? Give me a break. And be Mr. Wiener?
Some other interesting things in White Plains, particularly with regard to the Department of Motor Vehicles, which, in a sense, just leads us from where we were a moment ago. Evidently, they applied for and gained approval from the White Plains Common Council to move from their present location to
that
West
White Plains
Mall.
Plains Mall. Right. Then they're moving to where what used to be called Fortunoff's Thesaurus Mall, but Fortunoff's has left it, and it is now simply. I don't know what the official name of it is anymore, but it's where A.B. Dix is, Raymore and Flanagan are, where the Cheesecake Factory and Whole Foods, a new go-to supermarket in White Plains. And they want to put the Motor Vehicle Bureau in there. The state has asked for the permission, and the Common Council granted it. However, it appeared at that council meeting when they did this last week, Tuesday night, late in the evening they did this. They had a representative of the state come up, and the council asked them a couple of questions, and the state representative said, well, now that we have your approval for us to move in, we will negotiate with the mall. Now, what does that tell you? It means that they haven't hammered out the deal yet. And it was also asked by one of our councilmen, will there be free parking for people to attend to go into DMV? And that is a paid garage. Now, you get the money back if you purchase something, say at Whole Foods, you know, and you're validated. Now, how is that going to work?
It could work. Either you go shopping afterwards, or you don't, and then you have to pay a fee for the parking.
Yes, it could work, but that deprives them of a ton of revenue. I don't know if every store in that mall gives you free parking back.
Oh, yeah.
Or Furniture Place or A.B. Dix. I don't.
That should be the least of their problems to figure out.
Yes, but the real problem is the amount of space for parking in that. Because I know that the White Plains Mall used to fill up to the roof with parking, which was paid about $5 a shot for the DMV traffic, because the DMV was in there when there are no other stores doing any kind of business at all, except maybe McDonald's. Mm-hmm. You know. So now the question is, what will the DMV traffic be like? Now, the space, of course, is not upstairs like you would think it might be, but it's going to be right next to the Cheesecake Factory. How does that work from an ambiance standpoint? They haven't been able to fill up the vacated Morton Steakhouse area. It looks like it might be big enough for the DMV, but the DMV is going to have to install a lot of electronic equipment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because I was there at the Morton's once, and it didn't seem like it was large enough to handle the DMV. Does it seem like it is?
Has to go through a lot of absolutely wrecking the interior and redoing it. Total reconditioning. I mean, the DMV has lots of cubicles. They have lots of seats for people to wait. They have lots of number queues in the, which really improved service of the DMV, and that's all going to have to be duplicated. It's going to be a long time for that to take place if they haven't even started negotiating it. I don't think they'll be in there until January, and that's the earliest.
And what was the purpose of their leaving? What was the purpose of leaving the old facility?
The old facility, the mall was closing, okay, because a group had purchased it and was going to into a how many times have you had that phrase, mixed use and residential development with green space mall. And that was the first big innovation in the White Plains Transit District. That was 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they started doing this transit district revival, which hasn't revived much. And because projects have slowed, and one of the key ones that have slowed is the White Plains Mall, because the DMV is still in there. Now, the DMV was going to go over to One Water Street, but One Water Street fired a bunch of SEIU workers when they hired a new cleaning contractor, and then everybody realized how politically incorrect that is, because you cannot cross a union, you know, if you're a politician. And so it was decided that the DMV wouldn't go there. State decision.
Okay.
So they have been sitting in the White Plains Mall ever since, still. And now they want to get out again. Now this is, of course, stalling the whole downtown development. And so that's the story of how this came to be. So it's on a bus route. Negotiations have to start, and the policy decisions have to be made. The state has to find somebody to construct this. And as we all know, we know how fast the state gets things done when they're building something. Not fast.
Well, that's very true. Well, something else is very interesting. It may seem mundane to a lot of people, but evidently it's not when it comes to the Department of Public Works. They've got a one-man mechanical side-loading garbage collection truck.
They got ten of them.
This is phenomenal.
They have a fleet.
That's a beautiful.
And they're starting
actually,
to replace them. Yes. They're starting to replace them one truck at a time because they'd be obsolete after 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Heck, I've had cars for 10 and 15 years. What is this?
Mm-hmm.
How great can
don't
these trucks
know.
Be? I don't know. But they're very they apparently need refurbishing after a certain amount of time. So anyway, they have to distribute these receptacles. And in my driveway just this week, or rather on the side of the street, I see these three pails out there. I thought, oh, my God, they're giving us they're making a Saturday collection or something. But no, they were just dumping, instead of dumping refuse into a truck, it was in a rental truck, and they were putting out these three huge receptacles for each house in the Havilland's Manor neighborhood, and I'm also told in the Getty Farms neighborhood in White Plains.
Uh-huh.
Unannounced.
Really?
Unannounced, yes. So this week,
they put three containers that can be lifted through a vehicle that can pick it up through a metal bar.
A big crane comes out of the truck, dumps it in, and only one man drives the truck.
Mm-hmm.
No more you have people coming through the neighborhoods.
Great.
That are on the street that you can talk to, that you can wave to them and say, thanks a lot for holding your truck so I can dump my garbage because I forgot to put it out. I mean, I can't tell you how many times that's happened. They're very nice, and I will miss that. One more indication of the dehumanization of government.
Wow. So how come they're giving you three different pails, three different sizes?
Because one is for true garbage, like thrown out food and food stained stuff. And another one is for recycling stuff like cans, glass bottles.
Okay.
And then a third for paper recycling.
I see. Wow.
But this would mean that I think it all goes out at once. That's a good question.
Yeah.
I hadn't even thought of. Do I put them all out each time? That would be the more efficient way of doing it. Right now, you have a recycling day, you have a straight garbage, two straight garbage days, and a paper day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just doing this. I mean, it's very funny.
Well, it's
going to
be very
interesting. And they put out a letter via email Sunday.
Oh, really?
About this. Yes, after delivering. And it's very funny. It's on my website, and everybody can read it for a change. And I came up with the clever headline this morning of Scoop, and then a longer headline. But to my way of thinking, this creates a problem. Like persons who are aging up, you have to basically, I keep my garbage in a closed outside hutch, okay, to prevent coyote and raccoon incursions. They're an old Pentagon word, incursion, right? However, now I have to, I would, if I kept it in the garage, this attracts vermin. I once got rats because I kept garbage in the garage. Okay. People have to be careful of that. And
well, but these have plastic container tops, don't they?
Yes, they do.
That can
they
be
do.
Plugged in.
Right.
I guess it conceivably could fall, and whatever is inside might be strewn on the floor.
Precisely.
Well, it's going to be very interesting. And do you have enough room? In a private house to be able to put this out there so that the trucks can pick it up?
Well, obviously, nobody has complained about it, but look, if people complained about it, they wouldn't respond to it anyway. They just did this. Okay.
Yeah.
And that's what government does. They just do things. And all of a sudden, you wonder, how can this happen? They redo an exit on 287. We're going to spend $300 million on this. We're going to take 10 years. And when it opens, there's still the same old traffic problem on 287 West. Just less backup into Boyd Plains.
You sound cynical. You sound cynical.
No!
You know, it's
John Bailey cynical. John Bailey skeptical. I am a man of faith, incompetence, and... Our leaders, obviously, our leaders of our state government, our cities are the best people we can find, aren't they? Don't you believe that?
Yes.
Of course you do.
I do.
Yes, right. And they always answer your questions. Everybody answers your phone. And when you call and calls you back right away, that's our state.
Exactly.
That's my great story. Absolutely. Yes, Ray, look, we're going to have a lot of Texas refugees soon coming up to where we actually like minorities.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need them for our restaurants.
Absolutely.
Terrible thing to say. But I mean, yes, we do. Our hotels. And, and cleaning the government offices. Always important to have a clean government office.
We don't have too much time. We're only about 5 minutes left. But the question is, how are you managing in White Plains in formulating a one White Plains concept, you know, a future concept of development for the city? How's that moving along, or does that take just a long – is expected to take a long time?
It is – Well, we expect some sort of meetings on this in the fall because it's the summer and not much happens in the fall, except for things they want to slam through the Common Council. And the date that most people, the date when the big slam through date of the Common Council in the White Plains is always August 6th or 7th. I don't think it's any coincidence that when the slam dunk legislation is passed by the White Plains Common Council, it is very close to August the 5th, when a lot of people are on vacation. They can't come out. It's very hot, and they can do things with the least publicity. And since we don't have any media that covers White Plains with any degree of insight, you don't hear about too much about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is the pass-through date. So they're about ready to...
You don't expect a really robust conversation, deliberation over the future of White Plains? Or is that going to come sometime in August?
It's going to be announced in the fall, I believe. They're forming a mayor's committee of citizens first, i.e., read that mean a mayor's committee of citizens he trusts to make where he wants. That's really cynical.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way it's first going to. Well, I mean, that's what happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I've watched it for 20 years. And I mean, here's
absolutely
the thing. They're going to form this committee, and then they're going to form subcommittees, and they're going to have website portals where you can issue your opinions, and it's all going to be marshaled, and they will analyze them and tell, after analyzation, what the thoughts for the master plan are by the populace. This is the way they did transit district plan, which is basically hobbled, no end. And this is the way they're going to do the plan. They think it'll take about 2 years to firm it up, and then another 2 years to perhaps implement it. Now, that takes us out 4 years, 5 years. And the question is, if a plan is not done a little sooner, when we get can't get a handle on how the downtown is developing, will the plan be workable anyway? And, of course, the city has already announced that they want to work in something, or by zoning can be changed if it reflects the uses of master plan, but even if it doesn't, but it can react to the times. That means this is an exercise in basically making the master plan less constrictive for things the city wants to do in the future. It's basically...
Well, that's smart.
Well,
that's being smart.
Yes, that's just being smart. When you have laws that you don't like because they don't let you do what you want to do, you change them or throw them out. That's what we're seeing being done in this country right now in many states.
Absolutely. Well,
you need
flexibility in governance.
Yes.
And,
now, White Plains pioneered this. White Plains pioneered this approach back in the early 2000s when they changed their zoning for the city center project. You know, when Macy's was destroyed and a developer put up two apartment buildings. And this was a total change in zoning. And then they did another zoning change saying that if you own property adjacent to a property where you have the zoning, you could transfer it across the street. That was a brilliant piece of reasoning, and the Common Council passed it. And that was the day that zoning changed in White Plains forever. Spot zoning arrived in White Plains.
We're going to have to say goodbye, John. Just have a great week, and thank you so much for your input. It's always a pleasure on Mondays. Great way to start the week. You take care.
It's a little depressing, actually, but
well, you'll get
but
over it.
People
got to
know what's going
like
on. As they used to say
exactly.
At the end of Captain Video, warn the Earth, gang.
You got it. Anyway, I'll let you go. Be good. Bye.
So long for now. Thank you, guys.
Well, there we have it, and we've already got our next guest, none other than Michael Edelman. He's a national political analyst and pundit. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Hello, Hezzy. How are you doing?
Thank God. Okay. I always feel better when I talk to you. It really just jumpstarts the week, you know, like on an even footing somehow, which is important. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on in Washington, D.C., and President Biden's come up with some unbelievably broad concepts, and he's doing it through, presidential edict.
Executive orders.
Yeah, executive order. But he's changing the concept of our economy, and it seems to be very, very conducive, I think, to some of the changes that are going on in government. But will the Republicans help him along, or are they going to be adversarial?
Well, the Republicans are not going to help him.
You've got mail.
They're going to claim that what Biden is doing is going to hurt business and is socialist. But the fact of the matter is income inequality now is higher than it was in 1929, right before the crash.
Mm.
You have corporations taking advantage, buying back their stock, and the little guy is getting crushed. So what Biden is trying to do is to tackle concentrated corporate power and to break it up a little bit. Stronger enforcement of antitrust laws, greater scrutiny, for example, of mergers and acquisitions.
Yeah.
And the non-compete clauses will be gone. So you can't stop somebody who's working at a business from going into his own business by having him sign a non-compete clause. That is anathema to the idea of competition. And that's one of the other things that he's going to do. He's also going to try and get the United States Food and Drug Administration to work with the states to import drugs from Canada, because drugs in Canada are far less expensive than they are here.
These are huge, huge initiatives. I didn't even know he had it in him. But were you aware that these are some of the concepts of President Biden from the past when he was like the vice president, and it was just not able to be accomplished under the Barack administration when he was the vice president?
We don't know what he discussed with Obama when he was vice president. None of this was on the table at that point. He's now his own man. He now can do what he believes, or he can try to do, what he believes needs to be done to get rid of the inequality in income and competition that presently exists in the United States. And, you know, if he can get this done, bully for him. He'll go down as the most consequential president since Franklin Roosevelt.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is huge. And he's only the beginning of his four-year term. You know, he's only in it for, like, what, 6 months? That's it. So
yeah, that's all.
This is huge. But it's going to be by executive order, and executive order has got a lot of panache, but it's not law. So is it conceivable that he's going to get a lot of pushback from the other side of the aisle?
Well, he's already getting pushback from the Chamber of Commerce, for example. He's getting pushback from Republicans. The problem with executive orders is one administration acts one way, the next administration can get rid of the executive orders.
Correct.
And reverse course. This is an attempt by Joe Biden to level the playing field, to shift the balance of power away from corporations toward smaller businesses and toward lower and middle class households. We can't have a society in which competition is abolished.
Yeah, because if you have competition, then you give everyone a chance for a much more level playing field.
Correct.
Question, and also emboldens the capacity of people in lower and middle class in business to earn more.
Right.
So that gives them that emboldens them. But is this a big gamble on President Biden? Can he energize over the next year and a half, let's say, when elections will be coming on and a lot of people in the Senate and the Congress will be up for re-election? Can he bring the nation together where they recognize the value of what he's trying to do?
That's a good question. I don't know what the answer is to that question. I can tell you that he's going to try, and
yeah,
you know, to the extent that Republicans put up a roadblock, he's got the political argument that, listen, I tried to level the playing field and they stopped me. Look how much better the economy would be for you middle class people if they didn't stop me. So, you know, it could be a win-win. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be a win-win for the president, because then people will realize what he's trying to do, what he may have already accomplished if it moves forward. And then it would also decimate the Republican Party or the Republican brand even further. And isn't this a big
Republican Party
for the Republicans also to somehow come to grips with the fact that you got a Democrat in power?
No, the Republican Party is still stuck on the big lie. They're stuck on the big lie. They don't want to leave the fact that Donald Trump lost. They're still saying that he's going to be reinstated. There's no mechanism, by the way, to reinstate somebody in the presidency. It can't be done.
Yeah.
It's not possible. Okay? But they're holding out hope that, you know, because of their belief in conspiracy theories, they're holding out hope that the impossible can be possible.
Okay. Well, this is going to be very, very interesting. And it seems almost illogical to me that in all the years that I've been hearing about how manufacturing of drugs and important drugs that cost the American consumer a fortune of money is accomplished and produced in Canada for so much less. It's exactly the same formula. They have the ingredients are exactly the same, and yet there's a difference in the price structure. The health industry must be going nuts about this, but then the public is going to be just thrilled to pieces.
You've got mail. Mm-hmm.
Well, the cost of health care in the United States is far higher. It's far higher than it is anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and do we know why?
You know, yeah, we know why. Because
we can get away with it?
Because not we get away with it. The companies can get away with it. The pharmaceutical companies can get away with it. That's why, you know, there's no attempt to control the out-of-control costs that the drug companies are charging for their drugs. Where in Canada, where they, by the way, have a centralized system of medicine, they can, because they bargain on behalf of everybody. We don't do that.
Right. That's very, very true. What about like high tech and stuff like that, the banking business? Is that really a competitive platform, or is it not? The banking industry will tell you that they are.
When you say high tech, do you mean you mean social media companies, or do you mean, you know, other companies that actually produce a product?
The high tech think tank type of people who actually look and look at what's happening in the banking industry, and you'll hear the banking industry say, well, we're a very regulated industry. When you go shopping for a mortgage or when you go shopping for a credit card, and when you get a certain amount of a return on your money, if you deposit the money in the bank, it's competitive. But it's really not competitive, is it?
Well, you have a 4 or 5 banks that basically control the banking. So you have Bank of America, Citibank, Chase, Wells Fargo. They're the big banks. They're the money center banks. And but they're subject to competition. They're competing to lend money to people who want to buy homes and mortgages. So they have to compete with other mortgage lenders and offer competitive rates. They're not paying anything in terms of savings and checking accounts now, but that's because interest rates have been held low for such a long time that they don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed determines how much money the rate at which they can lend money to the general public.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when they keep rates low like they have over time, even the money center banks don't pay anything. You can't get – the only way for you to get a return on your investment today is by buying REITs or buying business development
real estate
companies
investment
or buying MLPs, mm-hmm. master limited partnerships. They pay between 6 and 10%. You can get can't get anything in the bank.
No. Get 1% or something.
Exactly.
Very, very interesting. Does President Biden's concept, will that bring in the Democrats who seem to be split in many different factions under one wing? Will he be able to solidify the...
That's going to have to work itself out. The progressive wing of the party doesn't want to go with a skinny bill, an infrastructure bill, for example. Mm-hmm. They believe infrastructure mm-hmm. includes daycare and childcare and things that aren't tangible, like roads and bridges and tunnels like that. So that's going to have to work itself out. Joe Biden, however, is a master at negotiating, unlike Donald Trump, who said he was a master at negotiating. And I'm sure he'll be able to work something out and bring the Democrats along with him. The problem for the Democrats really isn't the progressive side. It's Joe Manchin and Christine Sinema from Arizona, who are essentially conservative. And the problem for the Biden projects is that he needs all the Democrats. He cannot lose one because it's a 50-50 Senate. And then Kamala Harris has to break the tie. So if Manchin and Sinema go off the reservation, he can't pass anything.
So that's why at the moment he's heading for, presidential decision-making. And that's how it could be done. Executive orders. So that's the only way it could be done.
Right at this point, because the filibuster still exists. And it exists in a form it didn't exist in many years ago. You could actually just say, I'm going to filibuster this. You don't have to get up and talk for 15 hours like they used to be able to do. And so Joe Manchin, doesn't want to get rid of the filibuster, neither does Kristen Sinema. And that's a problem, because when you only have a slim majority, you need every single vote. You can't lose one vote.
Hmm. I want to ask you about another thing that's not related to this, but it's about American policy. America's leaving Afghanistan after 20-some-odd years. And yet I hear now all of a sudden that there's pushback, more vocal pushback for America to still stay there. What's the point? I don't understand what the point is after 20-some-odd years. And now that the Taliban claims that they have about 85% control of the country, and they're trying to run us out of town, and evidently effectively, and the old caretaker government is going to fall the minute nobody's there.
Yeah, that's true. All of that is true. All of that is irrelevant as far as Joe Biden is concerned. We've been there for 20 years, and he believes it's time to go.
It seems like it's the only logical move. I mean, we were in Vietnam as well for I don't know how many years. It seems like 20 years there, too.
We're still in a lot of places all over the globe. But the point is that in none of those places do you have a radical Islamic sect that is trying to beat the government.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Do we have you don't really do international stuff, but there seems to be a lot of strife all over. One thing that is very interesting is that there's a lot of strife in Cuba. And we've got a lot of Cuban Americans in the United States, but they're going through major, major struggles. And then we have a problem in Haiti as well. Evidently, a Haitian American got involved somehow in the overthrow and the assassination of the president.
It was apparently a doctor in Florida.
Yeah.
Who assembled a team of 21 or 25 or 30 mercenaries to assassinate the president of Haiti in order that this person take over as president.
Yeah. It seems to be the way in Haiti.
It does, doesn't it? But, you know, talk about chutzpah. How does a guy who practices medicine in the state of Florida decide that he wants to be the president of Haiti?
Well, you know, in the same way that the president of Haiti, Moise is his name, who was killed, he was a banana plantation owner. So I guess if a banana plantation owner could become the president of Haiti, you know, it's no big deal. A doctor in
Florida. Well, Jimmy Carter was a peanut owner, and he became the president of the United States.
Yeah, so bananas, peanuts, doctor, I guess it's all the same.
Yeah. Very good for you, by the way, bananas and peanuts.
Yes.
At the same time.
Absolutely. It's really terrific. So what do we have to look forward to now when we look at the national stage? Are we in for a major, major battle between the Dems and the Republicans in order to be able to get control of the Congress, in order to be able to function better?
You've got mail.
First of all, the nation is divided. Are divided in terms of who's going to take a shot. Do you know that because of what Donald Trump's been saying and what Fox News has been saying, people in red states are more vaccine hesitant than anyone else in the country? That if you look at a map and an overlay of the people that don't want to take this vaccine and the people that do, it looks like an election map on election night?
Yeah.
So
it's frightening.
If we can't agree on stopping ourselves from dying, as the Republican governor of West Virginia said, they're in the death lottery if they're not taking the vaccine. But if we can't do that, you know, what are we talking about in terms of uniting the country? We can't even get people to save their own lives because they think that the disease doesn't exist.
Yeah. It's truly amazing. And then President Trump, former President Trump, he just really had a some sort of speech that he gave. Was it in New York State that he came to speak, or was it in Florida?
It was in Florida.
Oh, it's in Florida, so he addressed the nation through Florida. I didn't hear a word he said.
Well, he can't address the nation anymore. The best he can do is hope that they pick up his press releases because he's banned.
Yes.
He's banned from Twitter, and he's banned from Facebook. So nobody's paying attention. But the problem with Donald Trump is that he will not give up saying that the election was stolen, even though he has to know it wasn't. Even his daughter and his son-in-law are running away from him.
So
this is a bad guy. This is a guy that thinks nothing about bashing the democracy and undermining our democracy and our courts and our institutions and our intelligence agencies if he benefits.
Well, he must be working.
Doing that.
Yeah, he's evidently working very hard. I hear that he's thrown up a lawsuit saying it would be illegal for him to not be permitted to be part of the airwaves, so to speak,
media. Here's the thing, Hezzy. You can't have a lawsuit that alleges First Amendment grounds against private companies. First Amendment only applies to government action. First Amendment only applies to government action. It does not apply to private companies.
Okay. So then he's got no chance. He's not on the platform that he loves,
which
was Twitter.
Yeah, he's got no chance.
And so he's got no chance at all.
No chance.
And so what is it that he's got this godlike figure in the Republican camp? How long can that be sustained?
As long as you have conspiracies like QAnon, and you have people believing nonsense, Donald Trump and Fox News can capitalize it politically and, B, make money on it.
Yeah.
Rupert Murdoch knows damn well that there's nothing to this election fraud claim. He's the one that had Fox News call the election in Arizona on election night because he knew Donald Trump lost, okay?
I
remember
that.
And he's in a position to do something to stop his own network from spewing lies, but he can't do it because the money is so mesmerizing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So we're really stuck in this between a rock and a hard place as a nation. And do we seize a greater discourse anywhere in the country, or is it what the driving force now are the Republicans and the Democrats trying to slug it out for dominance in the only power that exists, which is in the federal government? It really doesn't matter what we do in New York or in Florida. What matters is what happens in the Congress.
Well, no, you know, we have to find some way to let people that are skeptical about the vaccine and all the rest understand that they've been conned. This is not a short process. All right, so
it won't be. I just, you know, I still don't understand. Like, particularly in the African American community, I've been hearing that because of the way the Tuskegee Institute, the Tuskegee Airmen were being tested or being watched over syphilis, and they weren't watched for, in order to cure them, because they had the antidote for syphilis, which was penicillin, but they didn't use it, so they watched these people die on their watch.
They were experimenting on the black community.
They were experimenting on them. And so is that where some of the fear comes from, that people are being experimented on?
Majority of the false information is frankly coming from Russia. They're posting it online on social media, and people are simply regurgitating the Russian line. Because if you look at maps, as I alluded to before, you look at election maps, Republicans won't take the vaccine in large numbers, while Democrats will. And the vaccine works. We're not arguing about whether the vaccine works or doesn't work. It absolutely works. And it works against the variant, too.
Yeah.
So why won't people take it? I have a theory about that, by the way, if you'd like
to hear it. I did. Yeah, I'd love to hear it because I don't understand.
I have a theory that Fox News, to undercut the argument that Joe Biden has dealt effectively with a pandemic, and by urging people not to get the shot, what they are doing is making sure that the variant strikes in the fall and people die, in which case these people, these cynical people can say, Biden's not doing a good job. That's what it's all about. It's about depriving Joe Biden of the chance to claim credit.
And you think that that would fly, especially since you've already told us the rationale, but certainly a major rationale because of the adversarial position, a lot of people are being taken for fodder. I'm sure the you know, the those people that believe in this BS that's coming out from the right wing are going to say, yeah,
there's no other reason for educated people to suggest to non-college educated people that there's something wrong with the vaccine unless it's to undermine this president's ability to deal with the pandemic. That's the only thing that makes any sense at all. No reason
and
to do that. What they're actually doing is authorizing murder to save Republicans.
Yes.
That's what they're doing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But is there no response, let's say, could there not be a response from the Biden administration at that point and say, hey, look, we've been begging you to get inoculated. You're not, and your people have been telling you not. And now you're infected, and now what?
Well, that's why we have to wait until these people are infected. When these people die in significant amount numbers in these red states, they're going to come to the conclusion themselves that they should have had the shot. Once that happens, this bullshit will be all over. But until then, it's a disgrace that the people sitting in Fox News opinion host seats would try to portray the vaccine as some sort of socialist communist plot to take over, which is exactly what they're doing.
Exactly. Well, I think your concept is brilliant, and it would just I don't have this sort of audacity to even contemplate something like that, but that they evidently do. And it's smart of you to be able to pick up on it. I think you're right. It makes sense to me. Well, we'll see. Let's hope a lot of people are not going to die before they recognize the facts. Because people are not
dying
already from the inoculation. Yeah, they are.
No, they're dying already in red states. Virtually 99% of people that are admitted to hospitals and who are dying from COVID are unvaccinated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What does that tell you?
Tells me that it's not good. It's not working. I'm just very much afraid that the nation is just going to be ripped apart to such an extent that we will never be able to get together somehow. Getting together doesn't mean it's a kumbaya moment. It just simply means that we could talk to one another without blowing each other's brains out. It just seems that I don't remember this country like this before. I just never
That's
thought of it.
That's because we didn't have social media. We didn't have anonymous social media where you could say things about anybody and not have to stand up yourself and sign your name. That's what it's about.
How do you deal with that? I mean, that's like a big issue. That's always been a big issue for me. I prefer, you know, what I don't understand is that I used to always hear that if people would write whatever they believed on my website, there'd be retribution to pay, and that they might lose their position in some employment, particularly in the city.
Somebody's making a legal or a political argument on the website, you don't have to sign your name. But if you're going to say somebody is, for example, a lackey, just saying, you should sign your name.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
In other words, personal attacks should be accompanied by sign-off. But legal and political arguments to make a point, it's not necessarily to sign your name. If you're saying something lousy about somebody, that they're a crook or they're this or they're that, you should come out from behind the anonymity that these social media blogs. But because it's not fair, because you can say anything you want. You can make any accusation you want, whether it's true or not.
Yeah, I got something like that only yesterday. Somebody made a comment, and I commented that, you know, I don't understand where this wrath comes from, this vindictiveness. And it's not.
Well, some people are. That's what the Republicans are. They're relying on grievance. They're relying on white grievance. That's what they're cashing in on. And that's why they have to be. These people have to be disabused of the notion that Democrats, quote unquote, or liberals, quote unquote, are trying to do something to the country that shouldn't be done. Franklin Roosevelt was a liberal. We have Social Security because of Frank. Let them give their Social Security back if they feel that way. Let them give it back.
Yeah. So what's the best way of doing it then? I don't, you know, I'm really going to talk to my webmaster. I was wondering, like, if you make a political statement, I don't know how we could define a political statement before it's made. So,
well, it's easy. It's easy because if somebody makes a statement about this or about that, political people, you know, have to take a certain amount of criticism. But when it gets personal, saying there's a drunk or saying he's pregnant, I mean, all kinds of things that you can't find, you can't verify, right? If you can't verify it, people shouldn't be saying it. For example, if I want to say that legally, in the case you had of the police officer in New Rochelle, I was the DA in New Rochelle. I was the ADA in New Rochelle. All right? And so Mimi Rocha is doing exactly what a DA is supposed to do. Not everybody. Some of the posters are saying she's progressive. She's not. She's a law enforcement officer. Doesn't make a difference what her politics is. The way you handle it is the New Rochelle Police Department dumped it off. What?
Yeah.
What?
I don't see any political position taken on that. The law is the law, and that's what she's going for. And then
why would anybody want to
deny her the review? That's part of her job, is to review.
That's correct. That's exactly why she was elected. That's why she was elected. So when they say that she's a liberal and that's why she's doing it, that's not even close to the truth. The New Rochelle Police Department itself handed it off to the DA. And you know what? She charged the guy with a B misdemeanor. That will plead down to a nothing. Mm-hmm. That will be a violation before it's over.
Really?
Yeah. I did that all the time. You charge a B misdemeanor, you're going to plea bargain it. You're not going to try them on a B misdemeanor. There's no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
No such thing as a trial because it's not a serious crime. They're going to plead that down to harassment.
Wow.
And it will be a violation and nothing will be on the guy's record.
What's the point then? Why the introspection at this point? Isn't that the affiliated police benevolent association detective and president? Is that going to make it right?
No, but the police association and Olson in this case feel it's his obligation to defend policemen no matter what happens, and that is not the case. They should be defending policemen who are erroneously charged, standing by the chief law enforcement officer that's doing her job. They swore an oath. I'm no fan of Mimi's, but I was a DA. I understand she's doing what she's supposed to do in this particular case. Then they start with Jeanine Pirro and the baseball bat thing in Ardsley, and then it goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. Amazing, amazing. Well, I think we've overstayed our welcome, so I want to thank for really an exhilarating discussion. Thank you
You're
for
welcome.
Your input. That's more than a discussion. That with your input is brilliant. Enjoy the day.
Okay.
Stay healthy.
Thanks,
you
too. I'll speak to you next
thank
week.
You.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, well. Bye. Oh, always exciting. Michael Edelman. Unbelievably, just really terrific, brilliant man, unbelievable capacity of deduction, and that's all based on his knowledge and experience in so many in the legal profession, which is just absolutely brilliant. Well, we're going to be speaking to Ron Matten at 11:30 today, and so he is a Republican candidate running for Yonkers City Council president. So we're gonna get to him in a little bit, in about 25 minutes or so. In the meantime, let's look and see what else is going on the international stage. So bear with me a moment here. One moment here. I've got to get to this other page, and then we'll be fine. Okay. Almost there, guys. Sorry about that. I think this time we're going to make it somehow. Okay, I didn't realize I hadn't opened that page up. That's what's the problem. Well, let's look at what's going on in the world, because there's a lot of stuff that's been going on. Anyway, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan has handed over command in the country. So the commander in Afghanistan relinquished his command at a ceremony in the Afghan capital of Kabul on Monday, and taking the United States a step closer to ending its 20-year war. And the move came as Taliban insurgents continue to gain territory across the country. So another four-star general will assume authority from the U.S. post to conduct possible airstrikes in defense of Afghan government forces, at least until the U.S. withdraws or their withdrawal concludes by the end of the month of August, August 31. So General Scott Miller, who has served as America's top commander, his top commander, bear with me a second. You would think, Scott Miller served as America's top commander in Afghanistan since 2018. He handed over command of what has become known as America's Forever War in the waning days to Marine General Frank McKenzie, the head of U.S. Intelligence Central Command. And McKenzie will operate from Central Command headquarters in Tampa, Florida. So that's where it's going now, and we'll see how all this plays out. Now, very, very interesting. And this is interesting. The European Union hits a pause on the U.S. digital levy to focus on global corporate tax plans. It seems that the European Union has agreed to delay a corporate tax plan for the bloc following pressure from the United States administration and in a bid to facilitate a broader global tax deal. But European Union member Ireland reiterated its criticism of the wider reform. So the world's 20 largest economies endorsed on Saturday a plan for a global overhaul of corporate tax that would introduce a minimum tax rate and change the way large companies like Amazon and Google are taxed, based partly on where they sell their products and services rather than on the location of their headquarters. So the reform, if finalized in October, would need parliamentary approval in the form in the more than 130 countries that support it, including the U.S. Congress, where it would face opposition from the Republicans, and all European Union states would also approve tax reforms, including the envisioned global deal. So in an attempt to eliminate one possible hurdle to the global deal, the European Union bowed to U.S. pressure and said on Monday it would delay its own plan for a separate levy on online sales, which the U.S. administration feared could have led to more criticism of the global tax overhaul in the United States Congress. We've decided to put on hold our work on our new digital levy, the European Union Commission spokesman Daniel Ferry told a news conference in Brussels on Monday, noting the bloc will reassess the situation in autumn. The tax proposal had been planned for later in July. So the announcement coincided with U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's visit to Brussels and followed repeated pressure from her during a G20 summit at the weekend and before. So European Union Economics Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni told journalists postponing the bloc's plan would make it easier to concentrate on achieving the last mile, quote-unquote, of the global deal. So that gives you a sense of what's happening there when it comes to the tax situation. Then we've got problems in South Africa. South Africa is going to deploy an army to quell violence as a former President Zuma faces a court procedure. South Africa will deploy soldiers to quell the violence that erupted in the wake of former President Jacob Zuma's jailing, the military said on Monday, after days of riots and looting left at least 6 people dead. Disturbances worsened as Zuma challenged a 15-month prison term in the country's top court after weekend unrest by pro-Zuma protesters in his home province of KwaZulu-Natal, KZN, and Gauteng, where the country's largest city, Johannesburg, is located. Police said that 219 arrests had been made as opportunistic criminals appeared to take advantage of the anger some feel over Zuma's incarceration to steal and cause destruction. Any confrontation with soldiers risks fueling claims by Zuma and his supporters that they are victims of a politically motivated crackdown by his successor, President Cyril Ramaphosa. Now, the rand, that's the local currency, fell sharply after the military announced its deployment, extending losses to trade down 2% during the against the U.S. dollar by 12:30 in the afternoon local time. An analyst said, however, that the slump was also partly driven by fears over the economic impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. Zuma, who is 79, was sentenced late last month. Last month for defying a constitutional court order to give evidence at an inquiry investigating high-level corruption. Okay, so that's the situation there. We'll move on because we only have about 18 minutes left before our next segment. And this is very interesting in Colombia, too. We got a problem. Silencing a Revolt is a video investigation. It seems that a major protest that broke out in Colombia in April 28 had been marked by numerous acts of violence perpetrated against demonstrators by security forces and armed civilians alike. In a special report, these clashes were investigated using the testimonies of observers on the ground and the analysis of countless amateur video posted online. So it seems that on the 28th of April, Colombians took to the streets to protest against the tax reform bill proposed by the government. The bill, accused of negatively impacting middle and working class people, was withdrawn on May 2nd. But protesters remained mobilized, denouncing inequality, corruption, the assassination of political leaders, and police violence. So complaints of police violence have only increased as videos posted on social networks since the protests started show numerous acts of violence committed by police against protesters on a daily basis, according to the Colombian NGOs Temblores, Indepaz, and País. 44 people were killed by police during the first 2 months of unrest. That's the crisis over there. There's always something going on. It's amazing. Now let's quickly look at some other things here. Bear with me a moment. This is really important, particularly for a city like Yonkers, because we have a large Jordanian-American community. Jordan's court has handed a 15-year term to two former officials over an alleged royal plot, which we reported on a few months ago. A Jordanian state security court has sentenced two former officials to serve 15 years in prison over an alleged plot against the Western Allied monarchy involving the half-brother of King Abdullah II. Bassem Awadallah, who has U.S. citizenship and once served as a top aide to King Abdullah II, and Sharif Hassan bin Zayed, a member of the royal family, were found guilty of sedition and incitement charges. They are alleged to have conspired with Prince Hamza, the king's half-brother, to have sought foreign assistance. Lieutenant Colonel Mawafak al-Masaid, a military judge, announced a verdict on Monday following a closed-door trial that consisted of just six hearings. The two were sentenced to 15 years for each to two felonies, but the judge said only one sentence would be imposed on them. The two were arrested in April over an alleged plot against the kingdom involving Prince Hamza, the king's half-brother, and a former crown prince. Well, the royal family says it resolved the dispute with Hamza, whose exact status is unknown, but was never formally charged. Awadallah's U.S. lawyer says his client alleged he was tortured in Jordanian detention and fears for his life. The three Jordanians were accused of fomenting unrest against the monarch while soliciting foreign help. Hamza denied the allegations in video statements released in April after he was placed under house arrest, saying he was being silenced for speaking out against corruption and poor governance by the ruling system. Both defendants had pleaded not guilty. Abdullah is expected in Washington on the 19th of July, just a few days away, and a week away, actually, when he will be the first Arab leader to meet with President Joe Biden at the White House. Jordan's a close U.S. ally in the Middle East and is seen as a key partner in eventually reviving the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Michael Sullivan, a former federal prosecutor hired by Awadallah's U.S.-based family, told the Associated Press that the closed-door trial, which consisted of just six hearings, has been completely unfair, end quote. Awadallah says he has been beaten, subjected to electrical shock, and was threatened with future mistreatment if he didn't confess. That's what Sullivan said. The court denied requests by Jordanian defense lawyers to call witnesses, and prosecutors only shared purported transcripts but not audio from surveillance of the alleged plotters. The prosecutor's office at the state security court denied the trial was unfair, saying Awadallah was given the due process in line with Jordanian law and was not mistreated in any way. It said that Awadallah only raised the torture allegations as the verdict neared. Sullivan, a former U.S. attorney for Massachusetts and former acting director of the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, said that based on the way the trial was conducted, a guilty verdict appeared to be a foregone conclusion. He said any conviction would be applied. Awadallah, who also holds a Jordanian-Saudi citizenship, served as head of the royal court and government minister in Jordan. He has extensive business interests in the Gulf and has advised Saudi Arabia's powerful crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS for short, on attracting foreign investment. The Awadallah family urged the Biden administration to call for his release. Okay, so that's the story there. Now, let's look at what's going on in Cuba. More trouble. Thousands of Cubans have taken to the streets in a rare anti-government protest. Thousands of Cubans took part in rare protests on Sunday against the communist government, chanting down with the dictatorship, end quote, as President Miguel Díaz-Canel called on his supporters to confront the demonstrators. The anti-government rallies started spontaneously in several cities as the country endures its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food. Several hundred protesters marched through the capital, Havana, chanting, quote, we want liberty, end quote, with a heavy military and police presence deployed after demonstrators massed outside the Capitol building. Now, police used tear gas to disperse crowds, and at least 10 people were arrested while others used plastic pipes to beat protesters. Several thousand protesters, mainly young people, also took to the streets of San Antonio de los Baños, a town about 20 miles southwest of Havana. Now, security forces arrived soon after the protests began, and Díaz-Canel later visited the town himself, surrounded by party activists as residents heckled him, according to a video posted online. Well, the president delivered a combative television address saying, quote, "The order to fight has been given. Into the street, revolutionaries. We call on all revolutionaries of the country, all communists, to go out in the streets where these provocations occur and to face them in a decisive, firm, and courageous way." Now, government supporters held some counter-demonstrations in Havana. Social media showed several anti-government protests around the country, and mobile internet, only introduced in Cuba since 2018, was largely cut off on Sunday afternoon. Now, the United States reacted swiftly to the country's events, or rather to the day's events. So the U.S. supports freedom of expression and assembly across Cuba and would strongly condemn any violence or targeting of peaceful protesters who are exercising their universal rights, the U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said on Twitter. So the public is very angry. One local in San Antonio de los Baños advised that on condition of anonymity that she participated in the demonstration as she was exasperated by the, quote, "situation with electricity and food," end quote. Public anger has been driven by long food lines, worsening power shortages for several hours a day, and a critical shortage of medicines since the start of the COVID-19 epidemic, with Cuba under U.S. sanctions. Now, Cuba is experiencing its toughest phase yet of the coronavirus epidemic, and on Sunday, reported a new daily record of infections and deaths. The energy situation seems to have produced some reaction. Díaz-Canel told reporters in San Antonio de los Baños, blaming U.S. sanctions imposed by Donald Trump and left unchanged by President Joe Biden. He accused, quote, a Cuban-American mafia of, end quote, of whipping up the protests on social media. People have come to express their dissatisfaction with the situation they are living in, he acknowledged. Díaz-Canel has been president since 2018, succeeding Raul Castro, who served as leader after his brother, Fidel Castro. Well, the only authorized gatherings in Cuba are normally Communist Party events. A country of 11.2 million people was left relatively unscathed in the first months of the COVID outbreak, but has seen a recent hike in infections with a new record of 6,923 daily cases reported on Sunday, 47 deaths, for a total of 1,537. And these are alarming numbers, which are increasing daily, said Francisco Duran, the head of epidemiology in the health ministry. So that's the situation there. Let's quickly look and see what else is going on. Yeah, if you haven't heard, this will blow your mind. The U.S. West is sweltering in a heat wave. Death Valley reaches 54 degrees Celsius. Are you sitting down for this? That's 130 degrees Fahrenheit. The brutal heat was punishing the U.S. West, pushing temperatures toward all-time records for a third day on Sunday, as Death Valley in California, scorching at 130 degrees Fahrenheit, was again one of the hottest spots on the planet. A thermometer outside Furnace Creek Visitors Center in the heart of Death Valley showed 134 degrees Fahrenheit shortly before 4 p.m. on Sunday, and the National Weather Service recorded the temperature on Saturday of 130 degrees, which, if verified, would be the highest ever recorded on Earth. Anyway, so a ranger reassured the sidewalk temperatures outside, or measured the outside temperatures, and the visit at the visitor center at 178 degrees Fahrenheit on Sunday afternoon. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. So, weather crisis, that's for sure. Now, if you haven't heard, I don't know where you've been. Italy wins the European Championship final after beating England on penalties. Well, it seems that Italy won the European Championship for the first time since 1968 at Gianluigi Donnarumma. That's he's one of the players who saved two England penalties en route to a 3-2 shootout win after the teams had fought out a 1-1 extra time draw at a raucous Wembley Stadium on Sunday. Well, the giant keeper saved from Jadon Sancho and Bukayo Saka after Marcus Rashford hit a post as Federico Bernardeschi, Leonardo Bonucci, and Domenico Berardi all scored for the Italians. So Luke Shaw had given England the dream start with a superb goal after 2 minutes, but Italy, who offered almost nothing in response to the first half, gradually took command as the hosts sat back and leveled through Bonucci after 67 minutes. It was the first final to be decided on penalties since Czechoslovakia beat West Germany in 1976 and will be wildly celebrated in Italy after they lost in the final in 2000 and 2012. They made most of the running after halftime and in extra time, and England can have few complaints after their early promise faded away. It was nevertheless heartbreaking for most of the 67,000 people in Wembley as England came up short in their first major final since they won the World Cup 55 years ago. It had all started so well when Harry Kane spread the ball wide to Kieran Trippier, and he instantly repaid coach Gareth Southgate's faith in recalling him by sending over a curling deep cross that the fast-arriving Shaw met on the half volley to hammer inside the post for his first international goal. And England had given had taken an early lead in their 2018 World Cup semifinal against Croatia before eventually being outplayed and beaten in extra time, but they did not look like giving up the initiative on home soil, playing on the front foot, though failing to threaten Donnarumma. So that's the story there. So let's quickly go over to then our studio screen. Bear with me a second because it'll take a little bit of time to move there. And all right, one more second. This always happens after I read my notes, and there's always a backup of Twitter notices. Here we are. Bear with me a moment as we pull in none other than Ron Matten, who is running for Yonkers City Council President under the Republican banner. Good morning, Mr. Matten. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. How are you doing today?
Okay. Well, I'm more excited to talk to you, so that makes my day.
I have unfortunate news. I remember I called you earlier and told you my appointment had...
Yes.
That appointment got moved back to 11:35. Well, to 11:35. So I'm on a short. I tried to reach out to you, but you were on with Mr. Edelman. I enjoyed the show, though. I listened in. We have a few minutes, I do apologize for the scheduling.
Don't worry, it can happen. So we'll be able to do it another day. Not to worry. The big question is, how do you view your effort? And what do you bring to the table? You know, you've got unbelievable experience. You've got degrees in finance and so many other things. Do people recognize that as valuable, or are they looking just for a pretty face? I mean, not that you don't have a pretty face, but I'm just, you know, I don't want you to go away thinking, oh my God, he doesn't think I have a pretty face. No. So what's important to bring to the city council president's position?
I was out campaigning this weekend, and I was out campaigning in two dispersed areas of Yonkers. I was up in the Beach Hill area, and I was in southwest Yonkers around Lincoln Park, McLean Avenue and South Broadway, the South Broadway bid. It's interesting. Every time I campaign, I learn something new, which is great. And, you know, there's a lot of disaffected voters, whether they live in Beach Hill or whether they live in on South, you know, off of South Broadway, Elliott Street, or by McLean Avenue. They just feel, even if they go out and vote, government's not working for them. And what I'm trying to do is convince voters.
What is it that rubs them the wrong way about government not being responsive to them? How do they do that?
Well, not everyone follows the news, but the people who have, just look at the veto of the affordable housing that recently took place. And unfortunately, people are viewing that as the government does not want to work for them. And
in what way? I don't understand.
Well, so many of the people that live in Beach Hill have actually worked their way into Beach Hill from places like Buena Vista, from streets like Elliott, Lawrence, Ludlow. So they work themselves
up. Them?
Well, it affects them because they still see the path that others take. And even though some people have made it on their own, they still care about other people. Just because you live in a million-dollar home and you pay quite a bit of taxes doesn't mean you don't care how those taxes are being used, and you want to make sure that that's helping to benefit others. So the getting back to the affordable housing piece, it's a complicated dynamic between developers developing apartments, and I don't know that they're all being rented out appropriately or that they're being rented out at all. There's just a lot of concern that this is all not benefiting Yonkers, whether it be the people in Southwest Yonkers or the people in Northeast Yonkers.
Well, what I don't understand is how are these people who, you know, pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and by their own volition and their own desire, how does that undermine them in any way, shape, or form if there is going to be a housing that has an affordable housing component? There's already an affordable housing component. I think that the was to try to increase it to a higher percentage rate. I don't know how that's going to affect development. Some people say it will, other people say it won't. But then how does it affect the people who moved up the food chain on their own? Why does that affect them?
As you know, this development is being sponsored with some tax
benefits?
Tax credits.
You mean to the
tax
developer?
Credits. To the developer,
The developer?
When you're doing that, you're taking the money out of the tax rolls. So they're concerned that the taxes they pay are being used to benefit everyone in Yonkers.
Uh-huh, but not
so
them.
It's being used efficiently. I'm, as I said, I have to jump off for an 11:35 due to scheduling, and I do want to.
Oh, we're there.
I do want to continue this conversation. So maybe after your show, we'll call and we'll try to reschedule.
Yeah, absolutely. But you'll still be at a meeting until 12?
I will probably be in a meeting till 12:30.
That's when I begin my workout session. So I'll probably give you a call sometime after 11. At about 1:30, 2 o'clock.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Okay.
I'll be available.
Thank you
right.
for making
you,
your the time. Most appreciated. Be well.
Okay. Thanks. Bye.
So there we have it. Ron Matten, who's running for Yonkers City Council president, and unfortunately has a meeting to attend to, which is good, I guess. You know, I mean. Not everything revolves around the radio broadcast. So we'll have another opportunity to speak to him at another day. Okay, so let's just see what else is going on in our neck of the woods. And bear with me a moment. 1 second. One minute here. I want you to catch up with some, 1 second here. Yeah, this is very interesting what's happening at the Cannes Film Festival. Bear with me a moment as I pull this up. Where is it here? All right, for some reason, I didn't get the right page. 1 second. Okay, I think this time we do have it. This, I think you'll find this interesting. This is a report from France Van Cat. It's from the Cannes Film Festival, Cannes 2021, the city of Cannes, C-A-N-N-E-S in France, and this will be an audio clip which speaks about Ari Folman's search for Anne Frank. I haven't heard this yet, but it's about 10, 15 minutes long. Bear with me a second. 1 second. Okay.
This is a turning point for us as Asians in this country and around the world.
Because our histories and struggles in this country have been long ignored and even erased. It's time to change that.
Hate crimes and attacks on Asian Americans have skyrocketed this past year due to xenophobia and bigots trying to blame us for the pandemic. People are getting spit on, harassed, even killed in the street, just grocery shopping or taking a walk around the neighborhood. Don't get comfortable because this isn't a problem that's going to end.
Spreading awareness is the first step. So whether you're Asian or not, learn about what's happening and don't be afraid to share it with others.
Please pass along this video to not only share our struggles and our history, but to also share our strengths and continue supporting Asian nonprofits, Asian businesses, creators, and voices. Thank you.
Okay. This is Encore in Cannes.
Animation is still sometimes considered as entertainment for children. But here in Cannes, that's not the case. Ari Folman's Waltz with Bashir was a groundbreaking moment at the festival in 2008. This documentary brings in animated images to recreate the Israeli director's memories of his time as a soldier in the Lebanese Civil War. It premiered in competition to critical acclaim. Now the filmmaker's turned his attention to a historical touchstone, Anne Frank. He joins us to tell us more. Ari Folman, hello, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, your film focuses on a young woman who is a universal reference, Anne Frank, and you ask, where is Anne Frank? But I'd like to start by asking you, to us, in 2021, who is Anne Frank?
Anne Frank is the second biggest icon coming out of World War II. According to what I read with some brilliant historians, if you take a boy or a girl anywhere and ask them, okay, name two names two words that you know in regards to World War II. The first one will be Hitler, and the second one will be Anne Frank. She's a girl in captivity who was hiding in a secret apartment. She wrote an incredible, splendid, unbelievable, artistic, wise diary. She stopped writing. Most people will not know how she died, what happened to her, if she was Jewish or not. I mean, it was not mentioned in the Anne Frank House until, what, 10 years ago that she was even Jewish. So this is Anne Frank.
Up until a year ago, everyone was in love with me. Everyone? She was all so wonderful. Then everything changed. We're leaving. They told everyone we were to blame for all the world's problems.
Secret apartment is going to be our hiding place.
And I believe it was your own family history, in part, which persuaded you to get on board with this film, which you weren't so sure about in the beginning.
I didn't want to do the film. They offered me, and I said no. Not Holocaust. I had enough, and I don't want to do it. And then they said, they knew, they did their research, they knew everything about me. It was frightening. And no, I'm joking. But they said, okay, you read the diary again, you go back home, you see what happened. I read it, I found it as a father of three teenagers, incredible, unbelievable, that the girl at the age of 13 wrote it. This is sensational. You don't see it, by the way, as a teenager. And then my mother, who is a Holocaust survivor, told me, and she's a very Polish Jew, the cliche of the thing. And she said, look, we never interfere in what you're doing, so do whatever you want, but if you don't take it, I will die this afternoon. And you can come tomorrow and take my body. It will be neat and clean and bury me and everything will be fine. But you, it's your decision, you know, it's up to you. I said, okay, thank you. And she said, I will live, if you take it, I will live till the premiere. So she was 90 back then. I said, okay, I'm ending here. I thought it was 4 years. I didn't know it would be 8 years. But she's still with us.
A very wise woman.
Yeah.
When you write, who do you actually write to? To myself, of course. I prefer to think of my diary as a girl. A best friend. Her name will be Kitty. Kitty. I like it.
Come down, Anne. I'm waiting for you.
Is he a boy from class?
Of course.
Who are you talking to, Anne?
Now, the voice of Anne in your film is very evocative, really communicates her personality. I wondered how you went about the casting process and what were you looking for in that actress?
I think I saw, I don't know how many girls, but I thought I need to make a big difference between the girls. Emily, Karin, who's playing the voice of Anne, should be warm in her voice colors, very super emotional, which she is. And Kitty should be her alter ego. She should be everything that Emily is not. She should be more provocative, you know. She should have courage. And this is Ruby Stokes. I think both of them, by the way, will have great future as actresses, not just voices. They're already starring in major roles in Netflix series. So I think I made a good decision.
The way you built the film, it evokes the 1940s and also the modern day. And I wondered, what were the contemporary issues that you wanted most to engage with?
Look, I'll be honest with you, the refugee crisis was not in the original script. I had something completely different in the last act. But when this started, it was 2015, 2016, I rewrote the entire last act and I put it in. Obviously, we had so much trouble raising the money, so I had the time to do it.
Anne Frank is someone who has helped millions of people understand the horrors of war and persecution through her personal account. And that is something similar to what you did with the film Waltz with Bashir. It revisits your memories of serving as a soldier in the Israeli Defense Forces in the Lebanese War. That film was critically acclaimed here in Cannes in 2008 when it premiered. But you've said that your own memories were kind of fuzzy about that time. Were you a reliable narrator?
I'm not claiming to be a fully documentary, seeking for the truth, because I don't believe it. In general, I don't believe the seek of truth in cinema exists at all. I think if someone shoots 60 days documentary movie and he ends up with 600 hours and he needs to edit 90-minute movie, and he can decide about everything, there's no truth. And obviously there are different styles of documentary, but I always try to stay on the verge between reality and hyper-reality. And this is like the field that I'm really interested in. And Bashir is not telling any story which is beyond my personal story. He doesn't try. He doesn't pretend. It's me and what was surrounding me. And this is it. And it deals with dreams and subconscious. It is what it is. This is the only cinema I know how to do.
Because of the subject matter and the necessarily political nature of that, Waltz with Bashir was banned in many Arab countries, including in Lebanon, where many of the events take place. I wanted to ask you about that sort of cultural censorship. It often grabs headlines, politicizes artwork, and there's a wider movement to boycott Israeli art in place. What sort of effects does that have, in your opinion?
Mainly, what we see as boycott is artists not coming to perform in Israel. Bands, concerts, you know. This is how the Israelis feel it. And I'm not sure I have a clear opinion about it, because I'm very left-wing, very liberal left-wing, and I don't know who banned us recently. Because the bands I like, they come, Pixies and Radio. So, I don't know, Morrissey didn't want to come. So, okay, the people who would have gone to see Morrissey in a concert are very left-wing liberals. I mean, 90% of the audience. So he kind of punishes them in a way. I don't know if it's effective. To ban our art, what do you ban? If you want to ban a movie like this, that is a movie for children who tries to motivate them to be activists, to understand the horrifying stories about children in war zones in any time, what good does it make?
Finally, Anne Frank had a tragic story, but she's a truly inspirational figure from history. What do you think her greatest legacy should be for young people today?
I think that emotionally, what she did emotionally, when you read the original diary, about what it means to grow up your adolescence in captivity, is no one could have wrote it better than her. I think also the power of this story, that it has no violence in it and it has no cruelty in it, and this is why it succeeded. You know, there were more than 2,000 diaries written in the Netherlands during World War II. I don't know if it's the best one. No one knows. But this is the one, because of the persistence of her father, because of reasons I can discuss now for 3 hours straight. But this one worked. Because it talks about humanity, it talks about relationship, it talks about relationship between daughters and mothers that exist everywhere on the planet, you know, all the time. I see it at home. It does not change. And she did it so well, you know. This is why she won. This is why this one is the best. Because she was a great artist in the way she wrote.
Ari Folman, thank you so much for your time today.
This young lady here named Kitty is looking for Anne Frank.
Have you seen her?
to not write this diary so that you can worship her. What's important
the
do everything you can to save one single soul from harm. Just one soul. What do you see, Peter?
I see the Allied forces. They're coming to liberate us from you.
I see angels, Peter.
All right. Very, very interesting. Well, that's the end of our time today with you. So let's just quickly look. And one second here. Okay, cool. cut that off at the perfect time, and that was not my doing. It just happened. So very, very interesting. Now let's quickly look to see what we have tomorrow, because there's a little bit of time before we end the broadcast. It should be a terrific day. We're going to be speaking with Jeff Swartz and Brendan Beery. These are two law professors at WMU Coolidge Law School. These are the two professors that operate from the Tampa, Florida campus. And then it'll just be you and I, and we'll talk from 11 o'clock onward till 12 noon and catch up with some other stuff. So that's the story. Thanks again for being with us, and appreciate your patience for all our guests. That was all very, very good today. So we wish you a good day, and we'll speak to you tomorrow. Goodbye.